Good morning, 7:40 here on the Mighty 690. It is time for our Green Side Up program brought to you by Green Acres Landscaping, folks, and many other services they offer for you, too. So we are joined at this time by horticulture agent Jesse Gilmore. Good morning, Jesse. How you doing?
Good morning. Doing pretty good. It's been a minute since I've been on the show.
I know. I'm like, it's great to have you on here, and I know I've been, gallivanting around over to Arizona and stuff, so I didn't know who was on here a couple weeks ago. But anyway, it's good to have you on here, and always great to have you in studio. So, and we have Wendy in as well, Wendy Powell. So, good morning.
Good morning.
So, yeah, we're going to start off with Jesse's topic here to begin. But first, I did want to ask you, any upcoming programs, anything like that that we should know about as we get started here?
Yes, there is a local producers workshop, specifically navigating local selling, things like farmers markets, food safety, and that kind of thing in Parsons on the 23rd, which is Friday. So it might be a little bit short schedule for registration, but I believe they are still accepting signups for that.
Yeah, there's a late registration, $25.
Okay, awesome. So that's going to be at the Southeast Research and Extension Center in Parsons. So if you are a local producer, especially if you're a local fruit and vegetable producer, I believe they're also doing some meat and livestock talks as well. That would be something worth attending, and I'm pretty sure it's all day, correct? 9 to 3. I think it's 9 to 3. But more information, you should be able to find that online on our website and on just K-State Research and Extension's website.
Okay, excellent. Well, very good. Well, Jesse, I know lots of folks out there, you know, they got those Valentine's bouquets, and now it's been about a week exactly from Valentine's Day. So what should we be thinking about with those bouquets? Anything maybe make them last longer, or what's the school of thought on that?
Yeah, there are definitely ways that you can keep your bouquets alive and looking healthy for longer. Someone in our office was talking about how their bouquet was wilting, and I'm like, did you cut the stems? And she's like, no, I didn't cut the stems. So that is one really easy way to make sure that your bouquets are staying healthy is making sure that the tissue is not plugged up and that the water can move up the tissue in the stem up into the flower. Plants will scab and scar over wounds like people do. Not in the same way, obviously. Plants don't have platelets, but that tissue will callus and make it much harder for water to move up the xylem of the stem. The xylem is just the water-transporting tissue part of plants. And so you will, if you haven't done a cut on the stem recently, start to see your plants wilting. But the good news is that all it really takes is one cut to open that tissue back up and allow water to start moving again. When you first get a bouquet, and it's a little late for this specific tip, you want to do a cut immediately because you don't know how long the bouquet has been sitting there for. And when you do a cut for the first time on a stem of a flower, you want to do that underwater. And there's a physics reason for that, because the change in pressure, it's weird because you don't really think about stems as having air, but there's air pressure that is pushing, and you want to do it underwater. When you cut the stem, the atmosphere outside the vase or whatever container you're cutting the stem in is going to push that water down and up into the new space that's created in the stem by cutting the tissue open. So that's a good way to get an immediate suction of water almost up into the plant and to make sure that it's looking as healthy as it can for a while. Sometimes you will be given plant food if you're buying if you're buying flowers from a floral shop, they will sometimes send you home with plant food. Typically, that's going to be put into the water right after you buy the flowers. You don't want to really wait around on that. Unfortunately, flowers aren't going to stay alive long enough to use most of that, but if it's coming with the bouquet, you might as well use it. The only other thing you want to watch out for is when the water in your container gets cloudy. At that point, it would be time to replace the water. Anytime you make a cut on a stem, you want to take at most an inch off of the stem, and any leaves that will be under the water when it's in the container, you need to cut off of the stem because that can introduce bacteria to the water. And while bacteria is not nearly as common in causing plant diseases as fungi are, there are still quite a few diseases that bacteria can cause. And
now,
so
I've seen sometimes people cut those stems at an angle. Does that have anything? Is that important at all?
I think most of the time when you're cutting at an angle, that's more for increasing the surface area of the tissue that the water can go up. So there's going to be, and it's not a huge difference, but it's enough to where that little extra space might mean the difference between your bouquet looking nice and your bouquet potentially looking like it has been suffering from a lack of water. So typically, there's not a huge difference between the two, at least as far as I've seen, but it likely would do a little bit better for your flowers in the long term if you cut in an angle. Let's see, anything else? No, I think those are all the tips okay. in terms of maintaining bouquet health.
Well, it's good. It's definitely a good, timely topic here. So folks want to make those last a while, and flowers are not cheap. So.
Oh, yeah. But roses are the most common cut flower. They are also one of the most common shrubs that you're going to find in landscapes. And right now, the axiom for certain plant, there's easy mnemonic devices for remembering when to work on certain plants. So you plant potatoes on St. Patrick's Day, and you trim rose bushes on Valentine's Day. So pruning roses is something around this time of year that you want to do. Typically, it's pretty easy to understand the theory of pruning roses, but dealing with the actual physical stems and things like that is a whole different story. Those thorns can be pretty wicked. But when you're pruning a rose bush, you want to first look for any dead canes. And that's kind of hard to do because right now they're not going to be leafing out and they're not going to be flowering. Typically, the dead canes are going to be brittle. Anytime you think something might be dead, and this is true for roses, this is true for trees and shrubs, a flex test is always worth trying. So you take the outermost edge of a branch or a twig and you bend it. And if it is flexing with your bending, that means it is still getting water and nutrients and that it is still alive. If it's brittle and it snaps off when you try to bend it, at that point you can assume it's dead and remove it. But if the stems are still alive at this point, you would want to take it back to about half an inch above an outward-facing bud for the direction you want the branch to grow. So you can do quite a bit of pruning on roses, and they will take it pretty well. The only thing you want to watch out for, and I'm not sure how common it is in our area, but when I worked up in Johnson County for a landscaping company, it was everywhere. There's a disease called rose rosette. It's a virus-caused disease, which is pretty rare in the plant world, but it causes witch's brooming of the outermost parts of branches. It just really decreases the aesthetic value of the plant, and it will cause terminal illness in the shrub over a certain amount of time. And the problem is that it's caused by mites that live, or it is vectored by mites that live in the soil. So if you have rose rosette, you're probably going to have it even if you plant a healthy replacement in the same spot. The virus can also travel on pruning equipment, so if you think you have rose rosette, it's always a good idea to ask before potentially taking the disease from one shrub to another and spreading it through your landscape if you have multiple rose shrubs. If you think you might have a sanitation issue, a little bit of rubbing alcohol on your pruning equipment in between plants will kill off any microbes that could be transported on there. So at that point, you would be okay and not be potentially transporting the disease from plant to plant.
Good deal. Good to know. Jesse, while we have you here, I wanted to ask you a real quick question that came to mind because we do have some things starting to come up this time of year. I mean, we're unseasonably warm right now, but I've already seen some of those wild onions popping up. and for folks who maybe have a lawn or something like that, and those might be undesirable in that circumstance, is there anything we can do about that?
Dig them out. That is really the only option you've got, and that can be a real problem. And it's important to know if you have wild onions or wild garlic in your yard because of pets. Allium species are toxic to dogs, and I'm not 100% sure, but I think they might be toxic to cats as well. So you definitely want to make sure if you have a bunch of them in your yard where your dog or cat is frequenting, that they're not accidentally chewing on the plant. If you have a very mouthy dog that likes putting things or in their mouth or eating them, you want to control those. And unfortunately, herbicides aren't really going to do a lot. You're going to kill off the above ground portions, but because the below ground portions are bulbs, they are very much more survivable than just a standard herbaceous plant would be. So can cause problems. If you have a spreading yard like Bermuda grass, I would say digging out wild onions and garlic is more feasible because the Bermuda grass is going to spread and fill in the open spot that you've just created in the yard. If you had a bunching turf grass like tall fescue, it'd be a little bit harder of an ask to expect people to just create these new potholes in their yard for... well, at least my dog is really fond of digging, and so she'd make that a lot worse. Yeah. I'm so thankful she doesn't chew on them, because digging them out would just create many, many more problems for me. But, yeah, if you are concerned about your pets eating those weeds, they are edible for people, too. So if you wanted a, you know, chive source, basically they function the same way as chives. The bulbs are way, way small. They're about the size of marbles, so they don't get very big compared to what we think of as onions, but they are a useful source of onion flavoring, but okay. It's a lot more mild. Yeah,
that's good to know. I like chives. So
just a little bit of foraging information.
Hey, I like that. Well, hey, as we wrap up our time here, Jesse, always good to talk a soil test this time of year. Great time to be thinking about that.
Oh, yeah. I am getting swamped with soil samples right now, over the winter, most of the time, that's going to be crops and pasture, but spring is when people start thinking about their gardens, and so a real quick... primer on soil tests, and Wendy might be able to talk a little more about this if she wants to after the break. You have a soil test because you need to know what nutrients are in the soil so you're not accidentally over fertilizing and buying fertilizer that you don't need. You also need a soil test if you are currently encountering problems and want to rule out possibilities for what might be causing those problems. Typically, whenever we're dealing with problems that are linked to soil tests, it's going to be a pH issue, at least in the garden. It might be, is it different for pasture?
Yes.
Okay, it is different for pasture. Wendy might go a little bit more into that after the break. But for pH in the soil, pH causes micronutrient deficiencies in a lot of garden plants because it binds up those nutrients and makes them unavailable to the plant to take up. So in a lot of cases, if you're experiencing a nutrient problem, it's not that the nutrient isn't there, unless it's nitrogen, in which case most of the time it's not there. But it's in a form that you... that the plant can't use it, and so you need to adjust the pH instead of adding fertilizer. So you get the results back, and one of us, depending on what type of soil or what the purpose of the soil is, so lawns, trees and shrubs, fruits and vegetables, pasture, row crops, they're all going to have a slightly different need for specific nutrients. And so we make the recommendations for fertilizing based on what you have in your soil at that given time. When you take a soil sample, you want to take a representative sample or samples, if you have more than one sample that you want to bring in, from different parts of the garden, pasture, field. If you're experiencing one spot that's having more problems than another, it's usually worth taking two samples, one from a healthy spot and one from a non-healthy spot, to see if the difference would be considerable enough to make a make symptoms appear on plants. You want to go down a specific depth. How deep is it for pastures, Wendy?
6 inches for pastures.
6 inches. I would say for most garden-related questions, that's pretty similar. Roots aren't going to go down terribly deep on most vegetable garden plants. For most trees, they do have a taproot, but they're going to get most of their nutrients from the surface of the soil. So you take those, you combine them together. If you're getting multiple different smaller samples, like cores, for example, between 2 to 4 cups of soil for a garden sample, or per garden sample, you bring those in, we send them off, I get the results back for garden samples, and then I make recommendations based on what fertilizer you need. And that way you can be sure that your plants are going to be healthy, but that you're not spending money on unnecessary inputs.
Excellent, we like that. Well, Jesse, if people need to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
The Girard office phone number is the best way to get a hold of me, 620-724-8233. My email address is also jr637@ksu.edu if you want to send me something like photos for plants that you're having problems with, or a bunch of questions all at once.
Excellent. Well, wonderful stuff. Appreciate you coming on the program, Jesse Gilmore, horticulture agent, and Wendy Powell will be continuing on with us next segment. And so keep it here on the Mighty 690 KGGF as our Green Side Up program continues. We have news on the way here on KGGF. Back here on the Mighty 690, we continue our Green Setup program brought to you by the folks at Green Acres here in Coffeyville. And we have horticulture agent Jesse Gilmore and livestock production agent Wendy Powell back in studio. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
And we have Wendy here on this segment, and you know, lots of things to start thinking about as you know we're getting into you know, some more of the growing season and everything. Of course, you know, the cattle season never really stops, but
yeah.
we do have some things to think about when it comes to pasture management and weed control as things will start greening up and growing. That's the hope.
Yes.
So what do we where do we want to start with that?
Well, I have gotten lots of questions about when do we spray, and then what is this plant and how do I kill it? And I will say that the more times you put your shadow in your pasture, the more familiar you're going to be with what problems you have. So I've gotten some skeletons brought into the office over the last couple of months. And it's really hard to identify weed skeletons because they don't always have the branching is, you know, has been broke off through the winter. So it's hard to identify what a plant is when it's good and dead.
Yes, please. If you are bringing weeds into the office, please, please try to bring them when they're alive. It is so much easier to identify living leaves. Are for pasture weeds, are they the best way to identify a plant typically?
Leaves and seed heads. And of course, flowers are always very telling.
If they're there.
Yes.
But
if
they're not
they
always
them.
There.
Right. So whenever we're trying to come up with a weed control program, the foundation of that is knowing what weeds you have. So let's talk a little bit about the differences in weeds. A common one we have around here is ragweed. Everybody has heard of ragweed. It's the one that makes you sneeze and the one that no one likes. I don't like it either. I'm not saying it's a good one. But there's different kinds of ragweed. And some of them are annuals and some of them are perennials. So our annual ragweeds are common, lance leaf, and giant ragweeds. So those three can be taken care of when they're really small with some 2,4-D product. And that's usually more inexpensive than other herbicides. Now, if you have western ragweed, which is probably more popular around than the other three, that's a perennial, and therefore it takes more high-powered herbicides. So if you try to throw 2,4-D at western ragweed, you are throwing away your money. So knowing what plant you have in your pasture to take control of it, identification is so important.
Okay, Wendy, in garden situations and lawn situations, I typically recommend people spray when the plants are as small as possible in order to get the most control. That's not going to cause problems in gardens typically, but is that going to cause any problems in pastures with the desirable plants that you want to keep alive?
Yeah, so it all depends on what sort of pasture you have. So we've got like a Bermuda or a fescue pasture and you're just promoting the grass, then when spraying for broadleaf weeds, you're not going to have a lot of crossover. What kills broadleaf weeds most likely is not going to injure grasses. They're two completely different plant systems. But whenever you have legumes and clovers and other yummies in the fescue, then you have problems. And so that makes weed control that much more complicated, because what kills your broadleaf weed problem is also going to kill your excellent clovers. So knowing your timing is highly important. But if you're just trying to promote grass in your pasture and you're not so much worried about a Lespedeza or a clover population, and you've got a bad weed population, then yeah, hitting it as early as possible when it's growing, you know, as small as possible, get your shadow out there and figure out what you have and get it sprayed, because that's what's going to be most effective. Because it's way cheaper to kill a small plant than it is to kill a big plant, I can tell you that.
But they do say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Are there any strategies for preventing weeds from germinating and sprouting in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that segue, Jesse. So whenever you are planning your pasture weed management, look at your stocking rate. So last couple of years, we've talked about it many times. We've had a drought. So our pastures are in trouble. You know, we don't have a lot of growth right there. In some pastures I've seen, there's a lot of soil exposure. So they need to be much lighter stocked this year. You know, they need some TLC to recover, get those root systems healthy again, promote those good forages, and don't try to control your weeds, grow your grass, and stock at 100% if your pasture has been overgrazed, because you're just not going to get the traction that you want to see.
Is there anything we can do, for instance, maybe if someone does have a lot of bare patches, anything, you know, to seed to try to help things along? Obviously, a lot of stuff's going to naturally reseed as far as these native grasses and stuff, but is there anything else we can do?
Well, it really depends on what grasses have been there. You know, if you've got your natives and it had been a good population, or even fescue Bermuda, a lot of those, there is a seed bank there, so it will come back. The silver bullet is likely a, shocker here, soil test. So whenever we find out what nutrients are in the soil, and if there's problems with that, and typically there are, there's phosphorus problems is rampant in Southeast Kansas. So getting that phosphorus level on target will help so very much. And so Jesse talked earlier about the pH level affecting nutrient availability, and that is so very true. So we have to make for sure that our nutrients, soil nutrients are on target before we can really, if you want to reseed, that's great, but it's kind of like throwing a seed in water and hoping it grows. And it might do okay, but it's going to be limited. So if you're really going to spend the money on that, make for sure your soil nutrients are where they need to be. And to do that, a soil test is much cheaper than fertilizer and herbicide. So definitely make that investment. So one soil sample to be sent to the lab in our routine analysis package, which is pH, phosphorus, and potassium, that costs $13.
Yes,
I believe.
I think.
So it's not expensive, and typically people will bring in more than one. I think there's a quantity discount when we get like to 4 or 5 samples. So you can save a dollar here and there, but it's going to save you more dollars down the road.
So, that first package, I noticed you didn't mention nitrogen, and nitrogen is typically the leaf and stem, nutrient, and it is, I think, in most cases, the most important plant nutrient. And for grasses, pasture grasses, that are literally all leaves and stems, mm-hmm. Where should you expect your nitrogen to be when you get test results back?
Yeah, so the routine package that I typically recommend for pastures does not include that nitrogen test. You're right. And we simply don't test for it because it's so volatile. I mean, our nitrogen nutrient just doesn't stick around in the soil. And so if you've got native grasses, we don't really worry about nitrogen, because if you apply more nitrogen, you're going to be promoting more broadleafs than you will the grasses. In our introduced, in our introduced pastures, fescue, Bermuda, crabgrass, any of those situations, then we know that an extra 40 units of nitrogen, not 40 units of urea, but 40 units of actual nitrogen should give you an extra ton of production. So you can calculate your nitrogen application based on how much production you need, if all of the other soil nutrients are on target, you know, all those limiting factors. You know, if everything is correct, then an extra 40 units of N should give you an extra ton of production of Bermuda and fescue.
That'll add up.
So it will add up a lot. It adds up in the pocketbook, but it also adds up at the end of the day whenever you're calculating the bales of hay you've got or how many heads you can stock in the fall. So definitely do the math. I have seen a few nitrogen soil tests here in Southeast Kansas. It is available if you want to pay for it. It's a dollar or two, but you have to make for sure that you have excellent soil samples at the correct depth. It's not something that you can play around with. So, you know, give or take, it's accuracy, but usually our soil tests are telling us to apply more nitrogen than what is our baseline. So our baseline is 90 units of N for 3 tons of production. And then you can go 40 and then another 40 to get your extra tons.
It's so fascinating hearing the difference, though, because pretty much every time I'm making a recommendation for a soil sample in the garden, I am always, well, almost always, unless they have gotten a soil test in previous years with nitrogen, recommending them to understand their nitrogen levels, because nitrogen, I see it hover somewhere around 5 parts per million, and for gardens at least, nitrogen, nitrate specifically, should be around 30 parts per million. And so there is a significant gap between what you need for a garden and what you have most of the time. And I'm not sure if that's the same in pastures, but it is interesting hearing the differences. There's a lot more that goes into soil tests and fertilizing than a lot of people think, and what I used to think too.
Yeah, so that's an interesting concept, and we can dig into that a little bit. So for the handful of nitrogen samples that I've seen from here, or nitrogen results, I'm sorry, it's usually 1 or 2 parts per million. And so it's considerably lower than the garden. But if we really think about our goals for those, I mean, our garden is for consumption, enjoyment, things like that. Usually there's a bigger economic factor in our pastures. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that pastures are way more acres.
Oh, yeah.
So whenever you're applying fertilizer to 160 acres versus a garden plot
of 500 square feet.
Yes. The math is very different.
And the money's very different, too, I'm sure.
Yes. So it's definitely, you have to look at the end goal of those two different operations. You're kind of comparing apples to oranges, even though it's still soil, growing plants, things like that.
And timing, I'm sure, matters a lot more for pastures, too, because if you're accidentally applying the fertilizer at the wrong time and encouraging weed growth, that is really cutting into your bottom line at that rate. You mentioned actual nitrogen versus urea and how there was a difference between those two. Do you want to go a little deeper
into that? Yeah, absolutely. So with our fertilizer availability here in Southeast Kansas, we typically have urea for our nitrogen source, DAP, D-A-P as in Paul, diammonium phosphate as our phosphorus source, and our potassium source is potash, okay? So those are the common fertilizers that most producers are going to be familiar with. So let's dig into what each of those value. The easiest one to discuss is potash, okay? So whenever we look at the nutrient value of potash, it's 60% potassium. So it's like you can consider that like an effectiveness rating or something like that. So if you need math is hard. If you need 100 units of potassium and Potash is only 60% potassium. How much potassium do you need?
If you need 60 units of potassium, you need 100 pounds of potash.
Thank you. I said that backwards, didn't I?
I think maybe. It just makes more sense in my head that way.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's a percentage, basically. So you've got 60% potassium, but also 40% inert products that are typically going to carry that nutrient into the soil, right?
Yes, exactly. So then when we talk about the nitrogen nutrient, then we're looking at urea. So it's 46% nitrogen and a zero value for phosphorus and potassium.
But it's not nitrate.
Well, for pasture situations, we can keep it simple.
Yeah.
So it's 46% nitrogen. So if we need, you know, we can practically double our actual nitrogen to get our urea amount. 46%, almost 50, then subtract sure. if you know, easy math. Then when we look at DAP, that's what makes things complicated, because DAP is 18460, which is the three numbers that you'll see on the fertilizer label or on any sort of feed, like weed and feed, those sorts of bags. You see those numbers. It's a number, dash, number, dash, number. And the first one is your nitrogen, so urea is 4600. The second number is the phosphorus value. And the third number is the potassium value. And sometimes there's a fourth number on there, too. I forget.
Sulfur.
Sulfur, thank you. So with DAP, diammonium phosphate, its nutrient value is 18460. So there's 18 units of N per 100 pounds of DAP. So that means we can use less urea if we're using more DAP. So you have to get your calculator out whenever you're looking at your fertilizer rates, because you don't want to overapply, you don't want to overspend your money, and you can really go a lot farther with getting more exact numbers if you're using a soil test. And whenever you send your soil test through K-State Extension, I do all of that math for you.
Yeah.
And I do all of that math too.
Very, very money well spent on that.
Yes.
So, you know, it's going to be a nice day today. People can maybe go out and good day to take a soil sample.
Yes, absolutely. Come by the extension office. Maybe call first if you're wanting a soil probe. All of our extension offices do have soil probes available for producers to check out. And they can borrow those and pull their samples and bring them back. And it's a pretty easy process.
There are two things to keep in mind, though. If you do bring in a soil sample first, you want to do it earlier in the week so that the soil is not sitting in the UPS, right? Or USPS, whatever mail carrier is transporting the package to campus. Second, you also want to make sure that the soil is dry before bringing it in. We can obviously dry the soil, but it does need to be dry before we ship it off, and so that could create a little bit of a delay in you getting your results, which if you need your results soon, you definitely want to avoid. So letting it dry over the weekend and then bringing it first thing on Monday or Tuesday would probably be the best way to do it.
Yeah, and your other option, if you can't get it quite dried out, is just to keep it in the refrigerator. So just pop the baggies in there with the peas, and
yep,
you'll be good to go.
Honey, what is this in here?
It is not mud pie.
All righty. Well, some really great information, and something that we definitely need to be thinking about this time of year, because everything's going to start happening. You know, we're going to get into that busy season before we know it. So as we wrap up here, any other things we want to share? Any other events?
Yes. So we've got Animal Health Day coming up on March 7th in Independence. So that's going to be a pretty great meeting. Dave and Rowling is going to talk about goat care, and then Mark Ahrens from Molly Manufacturing, the makers of silencer shoots. He's going to come in and talk about handling facilities. So that's one of the handling facilities is always on my surveys of people want to hear about handling facilities. So we've got somebody coming in to talk about handling facilities. Hey. March 7th, Independence. Check our social media, our website, call the office for the details.
Excellent.
And I did want to bring up the Garden Hour webinar. We're doing Garden Hours again this year. I think we're going to keep doing that forever because it's been such a good webinar series for us. But March's webinar is on March 6th from noon to 1, so that is a Wednesday. And this upcoming class is on selecting and planting fruit trees. trees for Kansas. So it is going to talk about fruit tree varieties, the ones that are you can grow that are going to give you the most and least amounts of headaches. So like peaches for most headaches, plums and pears probably for least headaches. And it'll go into different care and maintenance for those trees. So definitely one to look out for.
Excellent. Some fantastic information. Well, Jesse and Wendy, appreciate you coming on by this morning.
Thank you.
No problem.
All right. That's our Green Side Up program here. We do that each and every Wednesday at this time. And we have Open Line on the way here on KGGF.